Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of the new series of For Fact's Sake, the Ferrets podcast about misinformation and fact-checking. I'm your host back again, Ali Bryan, and alongside me, my co-host, Paul Dobson. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, Ali. How are you keeping?
I'm very well, getting over the illness that we talked about last week and bravely fighting on. As we record this, you are inches away from going away on holiday. I know you're scared about people finding out where you might be going, but where are you heading?
I'm going to Spain. Some people would call it Spain, others might call it Catalonia.
Right. But
yes, we'll keep it as vague as that in case any of my enemies are listening.
Yeah. Well, let's just say you might go to the new camp. let's just say that might be an option.
A bit of a train journey, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So, we are back with the third part of our three-part series about the upcoming elections year. We've talked about the impact of technology on elections.
Yep.
We've talked about the disinformation trends that might impact the UK and US elections. Mm-hmm. And now we are discussing another huge election, the biggest election, in fact, of all the ones we are going to experience this year, and that is the election that's coming up in India.
Yeah, we've spoken to Jen C. Jacob from the Indian fact-checking outlet Boom, and we basically had like a very wide-ranging discussion about the political climate in India, about the massive challenges that a company doing an election in a country of that size and of that sort of level of diversity, but also about some of the disinformation challenges that face India as it heads into an election, which I think runs for 44 days in total, which gives you some idea of the scale of the operation there.
Yeah, yeah. And we thought it was difficult keeping on top of misinformation in a country of 67 million people.
Good perspective.
But so what we do into context, I think. So that's a really, really interesting chat we've got coming up. Also, we've got the next letter of the conspiracy dictionary. Obviously, started off with W, as is tradition. So the next letter was
C.
C. W. That's right. C. Yeah. That's how it goes. So
that's a curriculum for excellence.
Right? That's curriculum for excellence. Yeah. So you'll all know what's coming next. So this week's conspiracy dictionary is chemtrails. Mm. A bit of a classic, you might say, in the ether of conspiracies. So we'll be discussing all about chemtrails and why people believe in them. But first, let's start off with our interview with Jen C.
My name is Jen C. Jacob. I'm the managing editor at Boom Fact Check. This is a newsroom based out of India, dedicated towards debunking online misinformation and also verifying claims made by people in power. And we are also present in two other countries, that's in Myanmar and Bangladesh.
So the reason we're speaking today is part of a series we're doing on our podcast about the election year. Just elections happening across the globe, billions of people voting. The Indian election, general election, is set to be, people say, the largest election in the world. What are some of the challenges of running an election in a country of India's size and diversity?
As you rightly pointed out, it's the largest election that will be undertaken by any country in the world this year. Roughly, if I am not mistaken, it will be somewhere around 800 to 900 million voters. And there will be a lot of first-time voters as well. Those who have crossed the age of 18 who will also be first-time voters who will vote for the first time. The elections are extremely complex here because it's a large country spread across, over two dozen states. Also because of the the diversity that you see in this country in terms of language, culture, and also geographically, it's so vast that the elections have to be completed in multiple phases over a period of April to May, and has to be done in phases, because you know, you just won't have the infrastructure or the people to pull this off if you try to do it all together. So it's a massive exercise, and it's an exercise which happens once every 5 years. There are already suggestions, and there are already moves being made by the ruling party to try and bring all the state elections and the national election into one timeline, which should be happening simultaneously at any given point of time, rather than doing it multiple times. Because right. In India, every few months we either have a state election, then you know, we also have the national election that happens once every 5 years. So it's quite a complex exercise and very engaging, very exciting at another level, but at the same time very tiring for people who are associated with it.
So for listeners to this podcast who are maybe not aware of the Indian system or the Indian political climate, can you just tell us who the main parties are and the main politicians in India and where they lie on the political spectrum?
Well, the country is currently being ruled by the Bharatiya Janata Party. It's a party which is right of the center, came to power in 2014. So they have already completed, or they are in the process of completing, two terms. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has led the party in both the previous two elections, is campaigning and also hoping to get elected for a third successive term. The principal opposition party is the Indian National Congress. That's the Congress Party, as we call them. They are the oldest political party, right from the time of independence, over 75 years back, they are considered to be a party which is on the center, that is centrist or probably left of center. And then there are a lot of regional parties who rule states, who rule the multiple states that form the Indian Union. And some of them are national in nature, or some of them are regional in nature, but at the same time have aspirations of probably someday ruling at the center. So this is broadly the spectrum. There are a few parties who are left of the center, but the ideology and the prevailing politics in this country do not reward parties who are on left of the center. It's parties who are on right of the center who are dominating all conversations and also dominating the mind space of the voters right now.
We know that the World Economic Forum has ranked India as the most vulnerable country in the world to disinformation. Why do you think that is, and why have they come to that conclusion?
Well, there are multiple reasons. Our country has been, over a long period of time, there has been this continuous strife between two of the major communities, that is the Hindus and the Muslims. So a lot of the disinformation that you see are between two communities, or probably targeting one of the communities, which are the Muslims, who are in minority in this country as compared to the Hindus, who form the majority. Apart from that, political narratives are so strong here, either talking about the fact that, you know, that India deserves a place in the world which they haven't ever got, except from the time that the BJP came to power. Definitely, since India needs to be a world power, India needs to dictate terms to the world. So there is a narrative which has been very successfully built over a period of time. Apart from this, there is a very strong form of Islamophobia that exists in this country, which has been fueled by the right of the center politics that has existed. Apart from that, In many ways, when political narratives become extremely strong on social media, it means that they are going all out to woo the voters who probably are not already on their side, which means that technology is is used in a widespread way. In fact, not now, but this time again, we'll see a lot of those narratives spreading on WhatsApp and various other platforms like X and Facebook. But even the previous elections, in many ways, the narratives have been built over tech platforms. And the ones who are able to outspend their rivals in how they are reaching out to younger voters through the encrypted platforms like WhatsApp always have an edge. Apart from the groundwork that they managed to do and the kind of cadre-based political parties who always manage to reach out to their voters in the offline way, technology plays a very important role. So there are multiple reasons. You know, there is a communal fracture that has already taken place, apart from the fact that, you know, that there is always this this tendency to say that, you know, that India did not get its rightful place in the past, and it deserves to get its rightful place in the world economy and in the kind of statesman's role that probably the leaders here should be playing. So that does fuel a lot of disinformation and misinformation that we see, especially during elections.
It's interesting you're talking about the perception of India not getting its rightful place on the sort of world stage, because obviously from a UK perspective, we have it's almost like a similar, but from the reverse perspective, like viewpoint, you know, kind of narrative of like almost like, oh, the UK is like well-earned position on the world stage is slipping, or and then in the US that's a kind of similar, you know, they have that similar
Make America Great Again,
that kind of narrative that goes on. Yeah Make America, exactly. And the UK sort of has that in its own sort of slightly more minor way. But do you find that like the disinformation that you see in India, is it impacted by the narratives that like disinformation narratives from abroad? I know you talked about technology and the use of like X and Facebook. But obviously, the disinformation on those platforms can go cross border and impact people. And so, do you find a lot of some of the information is almost coming from outsides or being impacted by narratives in the US, for example?
Whenever there is a international event, for example, the Russia-Ukraine war, or the Palestine-Israel conflict that we have been seeing recently, or COVID, you know, if you step back for a few years, we've always seen that there is always an Indian narrative which you will find being spread by various handles here in the country on Twitter, X, and, you know, on the other platforms that Meta has in this country. Many of this disinformation that we see are actually outbound, rather than they being inbound. Yes, definitely, right. You know, our people here have a large interest because, you know, we have a diaspora spread across, you know, countries around the globe. So if something happens in the UK, we are interested. If something happens in the US, we are interested. If something happens in Europe, we are interested because we have people all over. So there's a very deep interest in what is happening in the politics of each of these places. Apart from this, the anti-Islamic hate is a very real thing on the ground here. So something may be happening in Israel and Palestine or in Gaza, but a lot of that will find reflection in the way narratives are spread here or pushed here to target the Muslim community in India.
Right.
And they will always project that this is a similar problem that, you know, that that exists abroad in many other countries. This is what we've been saying, that in India also there's a lot of appeasement, you know, by the liberals and by those who call themselves secular in favor of the Muslims. You know, the Hindus are the victimized lot. They are not getting their rightful place. So there is always this conflict that has been kept alive, and the polarization is so strong that even an average citizen out on the streets who probably may not have the kind of hate in his heart are kind of influenced, because they feel that if so many people are talking about it, there must be some truth to it. And the only reason why they think that there is some truth to it is because they're being bombarded by this narrative and by this polarization, which is hate towards a particular community or people, through the platforms that they exist on.
So just before we finish, I wanted to touch on Modi because we've not discussed him too much in this interview. So the Modi government has been accused of clamping down on free speech and legitimate journalism. And I know that certain journalists have had their social media accounts suspended on the orders of the Indian government when covering issues, I think specifically farmers' protests, that are obviously less flattering to the government. So is that an example of the fight against disinformation being used to actually restrict press freedom rather than the other way around?
I'm not sure whether there's a very clear linkage that can be drawn to it, though at another level, the government is also trying to build a fact-check unit, which was challenged in the courts, okay. Then has gone to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, by the time, they got some time, they notified it on their own. Now it has been stayed. So a lot of this drama is already happening here in the courts. But I would also like to say that it's not an easy time to be a journalist in this country today. Already there is this widespread narrative that has been built that you can't trust journalists, you mm-hmm. can't trust the media because they don't speak the truth. And one of the biggest beneficiaries of that narrative being built over the last decade has been the ruling party, that is the BJP. They have benefited from the media losing its credibility.
Okay.
Today, largely the mainstream media is seen as being extremely supportive of the government, which means that they don't question the government in any form. They don't question anything, any policies of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. They are in many forms, you can also see that they are virtual openly supporting, and they are open supporters of the ruling party, which goes against every form of principle that journalists should be following, where you are constantly critiquing the government or constantly questioning the powers that are, and also holding them accountable rather than working overtime to hold the opposition accountable. So it's definitely not a good time to be a journalist in this country, and there are many who, especially those who are not, who do not get national attention. There are many journalists who get national attention, but the real story is in the hinterlands of India, where they do not have institutional support, they do not have any form of support, but they're just doing it because they feel that those stories have to be told. There are state governments who come with, who use the strong arm of the law to silence them, to go after them. There are so many journalists who have been killed, because they were trying to tell inconvenient stories that would have hurt the interests of some, of some local powerful politicians or people who are in business. So it's definitely not an easy time to be a journalist in this country. But at the same time, there are many people who are working quite actively, trying to do their job, but they are always the target. About the fact that that platforms are taking down handles, this is a crisis that has been there for some time. There are platforms who say that that they actively push back, but at the same time, the government is also putting a lot of pressure on them, asking them to have clear policies where when a government official tells them that something is not true or something is false or something is against the interests of the country, the platforms are duty bound to take them down. The platforms are pushing back, saying that they are only intermediaries and they are not cannot be held accountable for something that people post on their platforms. But this is a crisis that has been brewing since some time, and some of these issues are still in the court, and we'll soon hear from the courts as well.
On this week's edition of the For Fact's Sake Conspiracy Dictionary, our new segment explaining all the most prominent conspiracy theories around the world, we are continuing our very conventional approach to the alphabet and jumping straight from W, last time for the World Economic Forum, to the letter C, and that is the linear progression. So yeah, this week we are discussing chemtrails, a conspiracy theory that I believe has been flying around, if you pardon the pun, since the 1990s. So Ali, first off, what is erroneously believed to be a chemtrail?
So yeah, you know the trails that come from the back of planes? Mm. Basically, some conspiracy theorists call them chemtrails and believe that they're clouds of chemicals used by governments or some other shadowy organization for a variety of alleged nefarious purposes, including mm-hmm. things like weather modification or population control. But needless to say, that is not the case.
What's the real science behind those trails you see on the back of planes, and what are they actually known as?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I mean, basically, it's water. And water vapor. They're also known as contrails or condensation trails. Mm-hmm. And basically, water is a byproduct from jet fuel combustion and comes out the back of airplanes. That's as straightforward as it is, really.
And there's sort of various theories among chemtrail conspiracy theories about what those trails actually are. So, what are some of the supposed effects of chemtrails?
Yeah, this has shifted about quite a lot over the years. Probably the most common suggestions are that they're for weather to control, to affect the weather, or they're to affect population through things like sterilization or mind control and things like that. Unsurprisingly, like many other conspiracies, it got linked to COVID-19 mm-hmm. During the pandemic. People claiming there were sort of mass vaccination campaigns were being delivered from above through chemtrails. So yeah, as you say, like a number of different things and a number of different like chemicals and methods have been suggested for what chemtrails are being used for. The only thing that these conspiracies tend to agree on is that they're being used for something bad.
Mm. And part of the reason we are discussing it on the pod today is that we had a story out a couple of weeks ago about forever chemicals, obviously, which come from various industrial products and have been found in water around the world. And I believe that some people think that forever chemicals are left by chemtrails as well. And our story ended up being used or being passed through conspiracy circles. So it's interesting how they can sort of twist.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel about that as the person who wrote the story?
It was interesting. I was very excited to see the numbers that story was doing. Less so when I saw who exactly was reading it.
Yeah, right, okay,
yeah. Yeah, I know, it's an interesting one. And how like real science can sort of be attributed to essentially like completely made up science.
Yeah, totally. And people will use what are a totally legitimate thing, a totally legitimate story as a kernel to like bolster their wild conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it's a weird way that like the genuine factual reporting can be bastardized and, and used in conspiracy theories. Yeah,
totally.
And where does the chemtrail conspiracy actually come from? And like, are there any prominent figures who push it in conspiracy circles or politicians? Or
I mean, it's been kicking around since at least the 90s. I mean, like, big time. Back then, you heard people talking about barium being mostly the kind of claim that was something that was being pumped out and being used to pacify the population's behavior or like modify weather and things like that. It's a weird thing because obviously this conspiracy theory is baseless and is not based on fact. Historically, there is a bit of a history of governments releasing chemicals on people from above. The UK in the 50s and 60s did these like germ warfare tests on the public. They were sprayed with chemicals on the public. Again, in San Francisco, there was chemicals sprayed on the public as part of a germ warfare test thing. Again, this is a completely different scale and a completely different, I mean, you know, every commercial airline pilot being involved in this thing is a completely different and unfounded conspiracy. Yeah. But it's like a lot of these conspiracies have a sort of like germ of like somewhere they come from, if you see what I mean. And then just get completely taken out of context and taken into this complete other realm of like fantasy. The conspiracy sort of endured. It's like many conspiracies. I think we've talked before in this podcast about things like flat earth theory and conspiracies have fashions and they have like ebbs and flows. They kind of at some point they're very popular. A lot of the kind of UK conspiracy conversations have like surrounded people like David Icke, who, if you don't know who he is, he used to be a TV host and a footballer, who a sort of one-stop shop for like any conspiracy you might be interested in. He has a website with a forum where like all the conspiracies like
are any conspiracy you really want. We'll have sub forum and people talking about it and all that sort of stuff. And so he helps, I think those sites helped incubate these sort of things. But again, they sort of ebbed away a little bit. It was probably less popular, and then seemed to be given a sort of secondary boost by COVID-19 conspiracies.
Okay.
And it's also been linked to, you know, climate change conspiracy as well. So it's these sort of things that have kept it enduring and stuff like that over the years.
It's always struck me as like pretty fringe. And one of the reasons for that is like the degree of conspiracy that would be required for, like, as you said, like every pilot in the world to be flying a plane that is spreading chemtrails, and all the people who work at airports to be involved in that conspiracy in some way. But do you think it's increasingly being harnessed in the mainstream? And how does it link to other conspiracy theories that we discuss on this podcast quite commonly? And have we seen any examples of politicians pushing it?
Yeah, that's a good question. How all conspiracy theories, or a lot of conspiracy theories, seem to have been getting more mainstreamed, you know, in recent years compared to maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And again, as I say, adding a sort of anti-vax conspiracy link to it has certainly helped to increase its profile, increase its maybe endurance a little bit. Yeah, I mean, in terms of people who are sharing it, one of the people who has been linked to it is previous person mentioned on this podcast, Robert Kennedy Jr., the politician, conspiracy theorist, and presidential candidate who's gaining a significant amount of support in the US.
Yeah, it was about 9%.
It seems to maybe a very influential figure in the elections. In November in the US. He's sort of flirted with promotion of chemtrails, and certainly he's appeared on podcasts and suggested some sort of sympathy towards the conspiracy. He is a believer in a number of different conspiracies and has gained a lot of his support by appealing to kind of conspiracy-minded people in the past, and has certainly helped to bring a lot of conspiracies into the mainstream, I think, through this this presidential campaign. He's probably the most prominent figure at the moment who's maybe linked to it. But yeah, it's certainly seems to have given a sort of new lease of life in recent years. That's all we've got time for this week's episode. Thanks so much to Jency for coming on and telling us all about the disinformation challenges that he and country of India will be experiencing in the coming months. We will be back in a while. The new system for Fact State Podcast is we are doing these mini series. So we've done 3 episodes on elections. So stay tuned for our next series, which will be coming up very soon. But obviously we'll still be doing our fact checking, we'll still be doing our reporting, and we'll still be with you.
Spirit.
Yeah, and you'll still be with us.
Voice.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to get in touch with us, how can you do that, Paul?
Yeah, so obviously we're on all the social media channels. We're on Twitter at Ferret Scott. We're also Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn as well. And you can also get in touch with our journalists via our community forum, which is community.theferret.scott. And Ali, how can you get in touch with you if they have ideas for fact checks?
Yeah, go to factcheck@theferret.scott and you can all those queries will come to me, and anything you want to have fact checked or anything about the podcast, you can send it there. Good to see that the rebrand of Twitter is really taking has anybody ever described it as X without also describing it as Twitter?
I still don't know what X is when someone says that.
No, I know. X. Yeah, it's not really
it doesn't.
No. So we are Twitter loyal here. We'll see if that maintains. We will see you very, very soon. Bye.
Bye.